And they will tell us about Yami from exact normalization.
Okay, well, thanks. Thanks for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be back here. So before I get into the talk proper, I just wanted to say very general terms what I mean by my title. So first of all, what is the exact normalization group? And it really represents a very physically simple idea, and this is just that the way we describe physics changes with the scale. So if you look at the universe through a telescope, it looks different from the way it looks through a microscope. And what the exact normalization group does is it formalizes this idea and allows one to relate low-energy physics in terms of high-energy physics through a sort of coarse-graining procedure. As for triviality, and of course I'll discuss these terms in much more detail throughout the talk, well, the context of that is quantum field theory, and when I start producing, start doing calculations in quantum field theory, I know that generically speaking I encounter divergences. So let me suppose I put in some cup. Now I have to ask the question whether or not I can whether or not I can remove this cutoff. And if the only way to remove the cutoff is such that I have to send all the interactions at all scales to zero, then that's what I mean by triviality. So I'll expand on that during the talk. So here's an outline. So I'll start by describing the exact normalization group in somewhat more detail and just give a qualitative overview. I'll then go on to discuss Wilson's picture of renormalization, which is closely tied in with the exact normalization group. And finally, from the point of view of the introduction, I'll discuss actual forms of exact normalization group equations, which I'll need for the later part of the talk. So this is all really introductory material, and the new stuff will come in the last section, which is on triviality, which I'll be applying to scalar field theory in four or more dimensions. And this is what I'll be talking about. I'll relate exact normalization group to correlation functions and apply that ultimately to fixed points. So, as I mentioned just in my brief overview, the essential physical idea of the exact normalization group is going from a microscopic description of things to a macroscopic picture. And this process goes by several different names. It's sometimes called blocking, or coarse-graining, or integrating out. And a good way to visualize it is with an example from statistical mechanics. So you can imagine just a lattice of spins. So here we go. So I've got my lattice, and at each point, we've got spins, which I'm going to take to either point up or to point down. And what I want to do to go from a microscopic description to a macroscopic one is average over blocks. So I can take this first block here, this block, 3x3 block. I can see that I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 spins pointing up and 4 down. So I'm going to replace that with 1 macroscopic up spin. Now I go along to the next block, I've got a similar situation, comes up. Now I repeat this procedure over the entire cluster of spins, and so this is what I obtain. And this is the first part of the exact normalization procedure, this coarse graining. But you can see that the effect is that my lattice spacing is increased here by a factor of 3. And what I want to do is I want to reduce this back down to the original lattice spacing. So the next step I have is to rescale it. So I can imagine that this block is part of some much larger patch, which I can't see. And so when I rescale it, that last 3x3 block has just become this one here, and these ones, which are off transparency. And what the exact renormalization group does is it implements a continuous version of this blocking. So rather than doubling or trebling the lattice spacing, I'm going to have infinitesimal changes. So an obvious question to ask is, what is the effect of this procedure of blocking as a rescaling? And suppose, just for argument's sake, that the model that I had in the previous transparency, I chose that the microscopic theory is such that only nearest neighbors interact, and this is just a choice which I might have made. Then when I do this procedure, what I find is that the macroscopic spins exhibit all possible interactions. And each time I do this procedure of blocking, the relative strengths of the interactions will change. So there's a nice way of visualizing this. So if you now consider the space of all possible interactions, so I might have, if you like, nearest neighbor interactions along this axis, and obviously the further I am along here, the stronger the nearest neighbor interaction. I might have next to nearest neighbor interactions along this axis, the further I am along here, the stronger that interaction. So I consider that space, then each point in this space represents a strength for every possible interaction, as far as I like along any of the axes. And I said that as I do this blocking procedure, the strengths of the interactions change. So what happens is I start to hop around in this space. here's that, and the transformation can have fixed points. So here's a little picture to illustrate this. So here I've got some fixed point of this transformation. And I've got two slightly different trajectories here, which I'll discuss in detail in a moment. Now up here I've got the microscopic theory. So this, for example, I might have said is just a nearest neighbor interaction. And what's happening is I'm hopping along this trajectory as I do my blocking procedure. So this one here is supposed to be on this surface, this critical manifold. And this is defined such that any trajectory which starts on the critical manifold flows into the fixed point. These arrows are just supposed to indicate that this trajectory here is just slightly off the critical surface, so it doesn't quite hit the fixed point. The critical manifold is spanned by the so-called irrelevant operators, and the reason they're called irrelevant is because as I do my exact normalization group procedure, the relevant operators become smaller and smaller and smaller as I go towards the fixed point. And if I want to leave the critical surface, well, I leave it along the relevant directions. These are the ones which grow under the exact normalization group procedure, and it's relevant. And a nice way of thinking about this is suppose that I want to actually tune this trajectory here onto the critical surface. And I can imagine if I'm an experimentalist, for example, this is ferromagnet, I want to approach second order phase transition, then I've got my magnetic field strength, I've got my temperature, two dials, if you like, which I can tune. These are my relevant directions. I've got n relevant directions, I've got n dials which I need to tune in order to hit this trajectory here to move upwards onto the critical surface. So how does one sort of formalize these notions? Well, the first use of logic is the Wilsonian effective action. So I want to start just with my normal partition function. You can see I've tagged it here with lambda zero, and this is my bare scale. So it's a short distance or high energy scale, and everything above this scale is going to be regularized. So in my previous example, it was essentially the lattice spacing, one over the lattice spacing. And this is the bare action. So this is just what I'm going to specify in my model. So I've got the nearest neighbor interaction or whatever. And I'm going to start off with my bare scale. I'm going to integrate out degrees of freedom between this and some much lower scale. But the partition function, the actual physics, is going to be invariant under this procedure. But nevertheless, you can see the expression has changed, because here I'm including all modes, whereas in this case, I've integrated out those between lambda zero and lambda. And these two expressions are the same, but I'm integrating over fewer modes. The effect of these modes must be taken into account somewhere. And it's taken into account in this action. So this is the Wilsonian effective action, and it's evolved from this bare scale to here. So I start off my action at some point in parameter space, I flowed along to somewhere else at a lower scale, and that's what I mean by my Wilsonian effective action. So it's the action that's relevant, if you like, to the scale, to the effective scale lambda. So the final ingredient is resignaling. So I've talked a bit about the blocking, the coarse grain of degrees of freedom. Then, of course, we have the rescaling, which is when I bump this thing up here. And so to actually implement rescaling, the examples I'll talk about, there's a simple recipe for doing it. I'm going to measure all dimensionful quantities in terms of my effective scale lambda. And when I do this, I need to make sure that I take account of any anomalous dimensions in the theory. So, for example, if I've got some quantity x, I'm going to rescale it to x times the full scaling dimension. So not just the canonical dimension. See that explicitly later. And I'm going to replace lambda with t, which is log mu over lambda. And the reason it's denoted by t is sometimes called the RG time. So you can imagine it's starting at minus infinity, when I'm at the near the bare scale. If the bare scale goes to infinity, it's minus infinity. I'm flowing towards positive time as I lower my scale. And the things that I'll need for this talk is that an exact RG equation has this form. It tells me how the Wilsonian effective action changes if I do an infinitesimal change in the RG time. And the fixed points are ones for which the Wilsonian effective action doesn't change over this procedure. And I should say that it's fixed points under the joint action of both coarse graining and rescaling, so both these things are crucial. We'll see why a little later. So that's an overview of the qualitative aspects of the exact renormalization group. Now I'm going to discuss Wilson's picture of renormalization. So as we all know, when you start doing computations in quantum field theory, one generically encounters UV divergences in limit diagrams. So here, for example, if we've got this one loop diagram in flight of four theory, these are the 4-point vertices here, then I know that this blows up in the ultraviolet as a logarithm for bare scale. And what I'm going to say is that if all the divergences that I ever encounter can be absorbed into a finite number of couplings, this is what I'm going to mean by renormalizability. And the exact renormalization group is a very natural tool to study renormalizability. The name kind of gives it away, it's exactly normalization group after all. And but the real point is on one hand it has a built-in cutoff, so my regularization is built in from the start. And also it relates physics to different scales. So now I'm going to go on to discuss continuum limits, and continuum limits essentially correspond to renormalizable theories. So it's just different terminology for the same thing. So I want to ask the following question. So I've started off with my action at the bare scale, lambda 0. I've integrated out down to my effective scale, lambda. So I've got some action here at the effective scale, nevertheless depends on the bare scale here. And I want to know if there are any of such actions which I can safely send lambda 0 to infinity. So in other words, I'm looking for renormalizable theories.
When you say you define renormalizability, how are counting renormalizable, I guess? The way you defined it is what people sometimes call power counting renormalized. Or power. I mean, it's.
So, in what sense?
That's what I thought you said. You said you expanded out everything in Feynman diagrams and then you asked.
Oh, no, so I haven't. I don't necessarily need to expand the example of Feynman diagrams. I use the Feynman diagrams to illustrate where the divergences could arise. But I'm just saying, this is really the statement I want to make, quite independently of necessarily any Feynman diagram
I know,
presentation.
But maybe it's irrelevant, but you define the term renormalizability.
Okay,
renormalizable.
So
how do you define that?
Okay, so this object here will generally have divergences controlled by lambda 0. If I can send, by sending lambda 0 to infinity safely, I mean that any divergences can be absorbed into a finite number of parameters. So I needn't identify that through diagrammatics necessarily. So that's what I'll mean by it.
Oh, okay.
So, well, there's a very simple answer which comes out straight away from the exact RG. Now, bear in mind that I've rescaled everything already using lambda. This was my rescaling step. And I've done this such that only dimensionless variables appear in my effective action. And what I find is the fixed points of exact renormalization immediately correspond to continuum limits. So the logic is as follows. This is what I mean by a fixed point here. Remember that T is essentially just lambda or log lambda. And what I've said is that I've rescaled everything using lambda. So if there's ever something dimensionful, a dimensionful quantity which appears in here, like lambda 0, it must appear as lambda 0 over lambda. So dimensionful quantities will be replaced. Can anyone?
Let's see.
So dimensionful quantity lambda 0, for example, would have been replaced by lambda 0 over lambda. So whenever there's a dimensionful quantity, lambda is always going to appear. So if I'm satisfying this equation, then it tells me that S star is independent of all scales, because there's no way it can depend lambda 0, for example, because it doesn't have any lambdas present. And if it's independent of all scales, it must be independent of lambda 0. And clearly, if it's independent of lambda 0, then I can say this to infinity. So the equivalent way of saying this is these correspond here to conformal fixed points, which are independent of scale. If they're independent of scale, they're independent certainly for their scale. I can send it to infinity, and so my theory is renormalizable.
I'm still confused on the terminology. You're going to prove that lambda 5-4 is in some sense trivial.
Right.
Are you going to regard it as renormalizable or not renormalizable in your terminology?
Not renormalizable. I'll spell out precisely the
scenario.
Okay,
the example you gave was, that was what confused me.
Oh,
so
example.
You gave an example for something that was renormalizable.
You mean the Feynman diagram I drew? Oh,
yeah.
I was just saying that to introduce the notion of divergence.
Yeah.
Sorry. No, I'll define in a couple of transparencies the precise different categories of renormalizable theories,
okay.
which I have. So those corresponded to conformal field theories, those like continuum limits, but are there any more interesting ones? I can go back to this diagram that I showed at the beginning. And I want to consider this trajectory here, and now I want to do two things. on the one hand, I want to send lambda 0 my bare scale to infinity, and as I do that, I want to tune this closer and closer to the critical surface. And in the limit that I do that procedure, what I find is the trajectory splits into two. So there's this part, which is just going straight into the fixed point, and I've got this part here, which is emanating out of it. And action, the longest trajectory, are renormalizable. So this is Wilson's renormalized trajectory here. And it's actually quite straightforward to prove this, even non-perturbatively from the exact renormalization group. But I'm not going to do that here. I just want to emphasize the point. The trajectory is emanating out of the fixed point, renormalizable. So the key message...
So the direction of the line is for lambda point.
Oh, right. So
when you say it goes into the fixed point, it's for...
Oh, so I'm going from ultraviolet at lambda 0 down to infrared. So the message of this transparency really is this, that non-perturbatively renormalizable theories follow from fixed points. They can do it in one of two ways. Either directly, in which case you're talking about a conformal field theory, or from the renormalized trajectories emanating out of them. So if I want to discuss things like triviality, I want to be discussing the existence or otherwise of fixed points. So here's a sort of a discussion, what I was mentioning just a moment ago, about the different types of renormalizable theories I can have. So the first case is trivial theories. And so what I've got here is I've got a Gaussian fixed point. There are no interacting relevant directions. So I might, for example, have a mass term, but that's not an interesting direction. That's just not interacting. And so as I flow down this trajectory here, I've just got a massive trivial theory. There are never any interactions. And this is a sort of uninteresting example, if you like, for renormalizable theory. Something more interesting is asymptotic freedom. This is again based around a Gaussian fixed point, but now I have some interesting relevant directions. And I end up with an interacting renormalizable theory, such as QCD, for example, or scalar field theory in three dimensions. And the other type of behavior one can have from a fixed point is asymptotic safety. So what I've got here is rather than a Gaussian fixed point, I've got some non-trivial fixed point up in the ultraviolet. Now, the reason I put GFP down here in brackets is because this isn't necessary for the argument, but let's suppose this trajectory does flow near to the Gaussian fixed point. The reason I'm going to suppose that is because then we can actually do some calculations in the infrared. So we might be able to compute in the infrared and find that the theory appears to be non-renormalized in the infrared. So an example of that, for example, would be flight to the four and four dimensions or gravity or whatever. But just because something appears to be non-renormalized in the infrared doesn't necessarily mean that it really is non-renormalizable. You can imagine this trajectory, if you're able to complete it all the way back up here, comes from something non-trivial in the ultraviolet. So this is the kind of thing which Martin Roydenko has been discussing recently in quantum gravity, possible scenario.
It's very general. There's something I never have understood. Why do you limit yourself to fixed points? I mean, there are in general, you know, flows and manifolds, there are all kinds of.
Right, you mean
to have a strange attractor.
Limit cycles, what have you.
Limit cycles is a very vague version of what. I mean, the simplest thing from the fixed point.
Yes.
Or in fact, why does it have to have any fixed points at all, as long as it remains in the parameter space?
Then
you still have a well-defined.
So there's two issues there. I want to make sure I can send my cutoff to infinity.
Yeah.
And these trajectories certainly satisfy that.
Right.
For more exotic trajectories like limit cycles and what have you, well, there are theorems that they can't exist in two dimensions. Beyond two dimensions, the statements become weaker and weaker. So I think it's fair to say it's generally believed that such things don't exist, but I don't think there's any proof outside two dimensions. I'm just not going to consider them further.
And what about things that don't approach any fixed point set, but they don't run up to infinity?
You mean, well, it doesn't matter what they're doing in the infrared.
In the ultraviolet.
Well, in the ultraviolet, these are the only types of theories of which I know for which you can send lambda 0 to infinity, for which you can send your bare scale to infinity. So I said, suppose I start at some arbitrary point, that I do my integration out, and I've got some action which depends on lambda, the effective scale and the bare scale. These are the only types of theories which I know that you can show that you can non-perturbatively send lambda 0 to infinity.
You mean it's the only ones for which you know a concrete example?
No, ones which you can prove it in generality. So you can prove generally that if you have a fixed point, the renormalized trajectory is renormalizable. So it's quite a straightforward thing, but I didn't want to include it here for reasons of time.
But is it just by definition renormalized?
Well, no, it's quite...
If you can follow the trajectory towards the ultraviolet arbitrarily far,
right,
then by definition it seems to me it has a continuum movement.
Yes, in some sense, yeah. But it, I mean, sure, there's the intuitive notion that it does, but you can actually straightforwardly actually demonstrate. You can start with your collective normalization equation and you can check that your intuition is correct. And you find that it is. You can do that non-perturbative, which I think is a strong result.
Some contributing. It seems to me just by definition it's true. You can follow it arbitrarily guidance. So I'm not sure what's being checked. You say you can actually check the guidance.
Well,
The fact that you can follow it arbitrarily far just means at each scale you can write down some action belonging to that scale.
Yes.
You can tune those appropriately.
Okay, exactly. So, I mean, so the way that you can demonstrate this in the exact idea, you can say, well, suppose that I start with a fixed point in the ultraviolet and I perturb along the relevant directions, then you can precisely demonstrate that the action along this trajectory is, I think you were alluding to, basically being written in self-similar form. In other words, at each scale you can write it in terms of the relevant couplings and nothing else at that scale. If I understood what you're saying correctly. Maybe I didn't.
No, okay, let's...
But anyway, what I'm considering fixed points and the trajectories coming from them as these being my non-perturbative renormalizable theories. And I'm not considering anything more exotic. So the scalar field theory in four dimensions, well, there's the Gaussian fixed point, of course, where the mass is relevant. The four-point coupling is marginally irrelevant, and all other couplings are irrelevant. So the only renormalizable trajectory coming out of the Gaussian fixed point is the trivial massive one. There are no interacting ones. And as for other fixed points, what I want to convince you of in this talk, that there are no other physically acceptable fixed points. The consequently, you can't have an asymptotic safety scenario here, and therefore the theory is trivial. So for the final part of the introduction, I just want to discuss the exact renormalization group equations that I'll be using. And you know, the key thing that I've been emphasizing for this whole construction is a cutoff. So first of all, I want to implement this. And the way I'm going to do this, I'm going to take my propagator, 1 over p squared, and I'm going to put in an ultraviolet cutoff function here. So that might take the following form, so it doesn't have to be exactly this form. It's going to be perhaps flat up to here, and then it's going to rapidly die off to make sure everything's regularized in the ultraviolet at the bare scale here. And I want to integrate out my degrees of freedom between the bare scale and the effective scale. So I introduce my effective cutoff, and I'm going to divide this cutoff function up into an ultraviolet part and an infrared part. So here's my ultraviolet cutoff function. And that's what I'm going to be interested in for the rest of the talk. But just a point of generality, it's also an infrared cutoff function here, and rather than formulating your exact normalization group equation in terms of this guy, you can formulate it in terms of this, and this is what Martin Reuter and Christoph Fetterich, for example, do. That's related to the construction I'll talk about by the Legendre transform, but I just wanted to mention this for completeness. For the rest of the talk, you can essentially forget about it, but I'll be interested in this effective ultraviolet cutoff.
In initial theory, do you still have a mess or not?
Not necessarily, no.
But if you have, you could decide to put an M in this propagator.
Oh, sure, yes. Well, let me come to that. I'll in fact mention that, in a couple of slides time. So what I want to do is I'm going to talk about the Polchinski equation. So this is a specific example of the exact normalization group equation. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to write it down, explain what all the pieces are, and then after I've done that, I'll motivate where it could come from. So what this equation is, it's an equation which tells us how the Wilsonian effect of action changes as I just change the scale. So here it is. Let me just highlight what all the bits are. So this is the interaction part of the Wilsonian effect of action. So you can see that the full action is the interaction part here, plus just my two-point regularized kinetic term. Now, as Raslan was saying, I might have a mass in my theory. Oops, sorry, not quite good. Let me just change notation slightly. So I'm just simplifying things. So this delta minus 1 is now going to stand for my ultraviolet regularized propagator, inverse propagator. So as Raslan was saying, you could have a mass in your theory, and I'm just going to organize things such that any mass term will be contained in S interaction. There might or might not be one. I'm free to put it in here or to put it in here. I'm going to choose to put it in here.
Well,
those
esoteric three dots.
Oh, right, sorry. I just want to say what each piece is bit by bit, and then say, Right. So the next thing is, so this dot on top, so this dot is just minus lambda d lambda. So by my definition, what delta is just the regularized propagator of this expression for delta dot. These other dots here are just telling me I've got integrals over the various undetermined coordinates. So this is a derivative, if you like, of position x, whereas this one is a derivative of position y. So I've just got an integral over the positions x and y over in Fourier space. I can write it like this. And just in the nomenclature, sometimes this is called the classical term, and this is called the quantum term. Not necessarily illuminating, but that's what they're sometimes called, and I'll occasionally refer to them.
So if you don't put the mass in the delta, are you worried that, for instance, the f delta dot g you define there might be singular, close to b equal zero?
Well, so delta dot is. Delta dot, there is a c prime where prime is a derivative over lambda squared. So there's no 1 over p squared here. So no. Because this one over this is c uv. So this is. Sorry. This is c p squared over lambda squared. So when the lambda v lambda hits this, it's going to bring out p squared over lambda squared to kill the 1 over p squared. So I want to recast the Poltoon's equation, because once I've done that, I can quite quickly show a justification for where it comes from. So this is my kinetic term, as I mentioned. I'm just going to denote it by S hat. So here I have that the full action, again, is just the interaction part plus the kinetic term. I'm now going to make the following slightly odd-looking definition. We can't clear why I do this in a second. So I'm going to define sigma to be S minus 2S hat. And the reason I do this is because you can see that this is S int plus S hat, and this becomes S int minus S hat. So with that in mind, let me first look at the effect on the quantum term. Well, here there basically isn't any change, because what I've done is this sigma involves a two-point vertex here, and if I take the double derivative of a two-point vertex, I get a no-point vertex, which is a vacuum term, and I'm just throwing away vacuum terms in everything I do. I'm not interested in the vacuum terms, so up to vacuum terms doesn't make any difference whether I have S int or sigma here. I can add or subtract any number of two-point contributions. Because I'm not interested in the vacuum terms, it doesn't matter. So much for the quantum term. The real reason that I'm doing this recasting here is because of the classical term. So what I want to note is that because F sigma has this thing of, if you like, A plus B times A minus B, when I multiply out the cross terms disappear. And so all I have a term which is quadratic in S int, and a term which is quadratic in S hat. So let me take this term. So this was the classical term, expressed in terms of S int. And you see I can write that, let me just take this over to the other side here, and I get two terms. One involving S and sigma, and the other one is quadratic one in S hat. So let me focus on this. The S hat is just this two-point term here, and so what I have, each of these derivatives, or the d by d5, hitting r by delta minus 1, 5. Of course, it's going to get rid of one of the 5s. So that becomes this, where I've got 1 delta minus 1, and 1 phi coming from each of these guys. I've still got my delta dot in the middle. And remembering the dot just represents lambda d lambda, I can rewrite this in the following form. So it's got the two-point vertex, it's got this derivative of the propagator, of the inverse propagator. So why am I going through this procedure? Well, here's the answer. This is the equation I started with. This is my Poltoon's equation. And I can rewrite it as follows. So this, I just argued, becomes this term here. And this one, similarly, becomes this one. And what I want to do now is I want to take this over to the other side. And what I'll have on the other side then is lambda of essint plus the 2-point vertex. In other words, I've got the full Wilsonian effect action on the left-hand side. So what I've done here is I've started off in equations in terms of the interaction part, and I've just translated it in terms of equations for the full action, so just where I've added the 2-point part. So finally, I can get to the point of this whole song and dance, and that's the following, that I can now simply justify where the Polchinski equation comes from. So to do that, I want to discuss very general exactly normalization groups.
And that's like, if you were doing gravity, you would be justified in the vacuum.
No. No. That's part of the reason for my visit, actually, and it's been causing us a headache for the last 2 weeks. So I want to start, I'm going to claim that this is a general form exact renormalization group. So it looked a little bit odd at first, but this is my justification for it. The point is that because I've got this total derivative on the right-hand side, if I integrate by d phi both sides, but on the left-hand side, I get minus lambda d lambda, the partition function, and on the right-hand side, I get an integral of the total derivative. So in other words, what I find is that this equation is just constructed such that lambda d lambda z is equal to zero. If you like, this is one of the ingredients I want to use from the very beginning for my renormalization equation. This object psi here, this is what defines my exact RG, and by that, I mean that it parameterizes the blocking procedure. So if you imagine, if you go back to the picture I had at the beginning of this lattice, I drew a 3x3 block. Well, I could have drawn a plus size block, or a 4x4 block, or a 2x2 block, or a 5x5 block, or whatever. And as long as I don't do anything pathological, the universe of physics shouldn't be affected by the way in which I do this blocking procedure. So this thing here, this represents the continuum version of this freedom on my lattice. And there's a huge freedom in its precise form. We can adapt it to suit our needs, and in fact, I will use this freedom a little bit later.
And but are you sure that any psi I would dream of putting there will correspond to some blocking procedure?
No, certainly not. But basically,
so there are restrictions on psi.
Sure. So basically, the restrictions that you need to implement, you need to make sure that it does incorporate ultraviolet regularization. You need to make sure that for each exact RG step, it doesn't introduce any infrared pathologies. And I think also, yeah, no, I think those two are probably.
Is this a theorem or is this a
non-learning? I don't know that it's a theorem, but it's certainly fine to choose it of that form. I don't know if there's anything, if you could relax that somehow, but I'm more than happy. If it's ultraviolet regularized, doesn't introduce any infrared pathologies along the flow, then I'm happy with that.
But I can't necessarily say that it corresponds to some blocking process.
Well, I think actually in that case you can, because there is an argument. If I can, I can tell you the argument after you, because it's out of the range of the talk. But yes, you can argue that if it satisfies those criteria, then it does correspond to integrating out, and consequently corresponds to the block. I'll leave that later. So the flow equation, I'm not interested in lambda of e to the minus s. I just want to, if you like, expand this out, so it's lambda of s. You see, this e by d phi here can do two things. It can either hit the psi or it can hit the s. And this gives me my two terms, my classical term and my quantum term. So finally, then, I can see where the Polchinski equation came from. Let me suppose that I take psi of this form, then I reproduce the Polchinski equation. So I'm not trying to give you a rigorous derivation here. What I am going to show you is that if you take the point of view that you're going to define your exact RG through some generalized blocking procedure, the Polchinski equation corresponds to one such equation you can arrive at. So that was, if you like, my introduction to the exact RG, and I now want to discuss how I'm going to apply this to the problem of triviality. And I'll introduce something called the dual action. I'm going to define it, discuss some of its properties, and then show intuitively what it represents. So this is my definition here. I've got d by d phi is equal to the logarithm. I've got e, the interaction part of the action here, and I've got this operator, which looks very similar to the thing in the Polchinski equation, but note that there isn't a dot above this guy, and so I do need to worry about the infrared divergences that Brassbaum was talking about, because this does have a 1 over p squared. Now the properties of this, it's very straightforward, just by applying the Polchinski equation to this, to show that its flow vanishes. And consequently, you can think of its vertices and invariants with exact log g. Now, rather than actually going through and showing this, although it's straightforward, I want to tell you intuitively why you'd anyway expect this to be true. So to do this, I want to introduce some diagrammatics. And I want to go into a little bit of the philosophy of my diagrammatics first. So ultimately, what I want to do is I want to manipulate this expression here. There may be a better way of doing this than what I'm going to do. This is the best that I can do. So I'm going to expand the exponentials here. I'm going to expand the Wilsonian effect of action to this guy and powers of the fields. And what I'm going to do next is, rather than doing algebraic manipulations, I'm going to do diagrammatic manipulations. So whenever I do diagrammatic stuff, you can always imagine that what I'm really doing is I'm manipulating the series expansion of this. None of the series, diagrammatic or otherwise, will ever be truncated. And moreover, no perturbative expansion of this guy is ever going to be performed. So I hope the procedure that I'm performing is, at least in some sense, reasonably well defined. And I'm not going to use the diagrammatics for everything, and I'll point out precisely at what stage they become necessary. Because sometimes they're used just for interpretation. I'll flag that, and I'll also flag when I use them for actually doing their calculations. So here are the diagrammatics, so hopefully it's quite intuitive. So this is my interaction Wilsonian effect of action. Here's my two-point vertex, so I've just got an SI that I've written inside this. And the reason that I do a big blob here is because I've got several things in my theory. I've got SI, I've got S without an I, and I've got S hat. And I draw a nice big circle so I can put inside which one of these it is. If you prefer, you can just pinch the circle to a point. So this would just look like a standard four-point circle. So of course, the two-point vertex has two legs, the four-point vertex has four legs, and so forth. And this dual action is made up of the complete diagrammatic expansion. So the way that one can see this is as follows. So if one remembers that dual action was composed at this object appearing in it, and you can imagine that what this does is it's hitting various vertices which are coming from this. So this thing here, let me write this when I expand this out. I might have one vertex up here, one vertex down here, one vertex down here. And what these d by d fines do is they eat fields, if you like. And this thing can either eat a field, a pair of fields on the same vertex, in which case it joins them together with an internal line, or it can eat fields on different vertices, in which case it joins the two vertices together. So this two-point dual action is just composed of all diagrams that I can draw, all connected diagrams that I can draw, with two legs, and it includes one particle reducible terms.
Your first order? That's a particle, the one with one half in front.
Right, so yeah, so normally one would draw that as the mass correction. So I just want to expand out the dots so I can say that this is SI.
The first line is the definition of SI?
This is what I mean by my diagrammatic expansion. So this is what, if I'm expanding the powers of fields, I'm going to call the two-point coefficient this thing with two legs. So yeah. And this is obviously very schematic. I don't necessarily mean that there's no momentum dependence in it. It's just a schematic notation.
Then when I read the D2, you have graphs with one block, with two blocks, with three blocks, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Still, you don't call this a perturbative expansion. Why?
Well,
consider that it perturbs, you know, in blocks. Instead of it being the bare vertex, it's the block, but it's still a perturbative expansion.
Okay, it's a perturbative expansion in block, sure, but it's not a perturbative expansion resulting in lambda because I haven't said anything about these guys here. So what I haven't done is I haven't additionally expanded out the vertices of some power series in lambda. Now, I've had to do this expansion here because I don't know how to do this without doing it. There might be some better way to proceed. This is the best that I can do at the moment.
Well, presumably this series does converge.
Well, I hope it converges. So let me explain now why the flow vanishes, what they're related to, and why I therefore think that they make sense.
Apparently, this series Yeah, actually has more terms than a usual perturbative expansion because
right.
you don't only have four terms, four legs, but you have blocks with six legs and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Well, it would have, okay, so it's like doing a Feynman diagram expansion, where it's like doing an expansion but where you've got not just 4-point vertices exactly, but 6-point
vertices. If we restrict only to 4-point vertices, this will look very similar to the usual perturbative expansion.
Right,
now
sure.
we know that that series is never summable.
Indeed.
So when do we suppose that this one would be summable?
Right, because this one includes, for example, this one will include not just the perturbative parts of the series, it will also include the power corrections, which would hopefully allow you to Borel, well, resum it, in brackets, Borel resum it.
Because there's, you're hoping for cancellation.
Well, not cancellations per se. I haven't thrown away any of the non-perturbative information from the vertices. Right, so these vertices are the ones which appear in the exact flow equation. And I'm not doing any truncation of what I mean by my vertices, I'm not doing any expansion of my vertices. So if, for example, I were in near the Gaussian fixed point in four dimensions, I could write this out, I could write out the perturbative parts of this, but I also have, there are certainly non-perturbative corrections to that. And, well, I'm about to go on to show that these are the correlation functions, and in that sense, I would hope that they are well-defined. So these are my correlation functions. If my theory makes sense, I expect my correlation functions to make sense. So I'd expect to be able to at least resum the series, but I don't really prove it.
No, so, but just understand, the idea is that the origin of the non-summability of the standard perturbative expansion comes from having neglected some non-perturbative
right, contributions. So, exactly, so the standard perturbative series is by itself ambiguous. It needs the non-perturbative contributions to make it unambiguous. And here I've got, hopefully, all the contributions, so I should, if it is resum, we'll be able to resum it. So, the reason that the flow of these vertices is zero is because they're essentially correlation functions. So what I want to do is forget about the exact normalization group for the moment, forget about these cutoffs and so forth, but just imagine constructing, say, for example, a four-point correlation function from the pair action. So this is my four-point connected correlation function, and the first thing I can do, I've got my four external fields here, I can join them all together at a point. This diagram here, and then the plus dot 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 just represents all possible diagrams I can draw with four external legs. Well, I know that the sum of all diagrams with the external legs is precisely what I've been calling my dual action four-point vertex, but the difference between these expressions here is that I need a bare propagator to join my field, which I imagine is here, to the vertex. So I've got the four-point correlation function, four-point dual action vertex, bare scale, times these four bare propagators. But I've just told you that the dual action is independent of the scale here, and so I can drop that b, because it doesn't matter what scale I evaluate this at. So this is generally true for any n greater than 2. And so the lesson is that the n greater than 2-point dual action vertices are basically the endpoint correlation function. So it's no surprise that they come out independent of my effective scale, which is just an auxiliary construction, if you like, to help me evaluate the path. So what about the two-point correlation function? Well, this is very similar. So now let me consider constructing two-point connected correlation functions. And the point is now is my first contribution is a bare propagator, because I've got my two fields here. The first thing I can do is just draw a line between them without any plots. And so the full contribution is a single line, and then, of course, the other thing I can do, here are my two fields, I have a single line with a blob in the middle, and then another single line. So I've got these two things here, my second contributions. And again, I've dropped the B going from here to here, because I said that it's independent of scale. So I want to introduce two more ingredients, hopefully all of which should be familiar. So the first is the one possibly reducible vertices. My notation is, if I put a bar above it, I just mean it's the one behind these. So an example, if I look at the two-point vertex, this hashed out thing here is my one particle reducible piece, and as usual, I have my geometric expansion. And so what I can write is I can write that d2 is equal to d bar 2 over here. You see, if I expand this out, well, my first term is this, my next term picks up a minus sign, an extra propagator, an extra blob, and so forth. So this is just the usual introduction to one-guy vertices. And along exactly the same lines, I want to introduce the dressed effective propagator. So sorry, I should say, so my black line, these black internal lines, rather than calling them a propagator, I call them effective because they've got this regularization built in. And by a red line, I'm going to denote this as the complete dress sequence. So I start by drawing a single line, and of course I've got this one blob in the middle and two blobs. And again, I can resolve the geometric series here. So this is just exactly standard. Let me just interpret my dress effect propagator. You see I can rewrite this in a few different ways. I can also rewrite it like this. And if I recall that my two-point function, well, it basically has exactly the same form, except instead of these faker propagators, it's got the bare one. So the interpretation of this dress effective propagator is it's the UV regularized, the regularized effective scale, version of the two-point correlation function.
How is the last writing working? Is an
expansion?
An approximation?
No, sorry, it's not an approximation. So we've got.
D bar has become B.
D bar has become B. There's just various different ways you can rewrite this. Yeah. So I just wanted to do this just to make the point that this is very similar to this expression after the fact. This is bare, whilst this is effective. So the final thing I need to do before I can discuss triviality, when I said that I want to discuss fixed points, and I said it's one color fixed point behavior, one of the important ingredients is rescaling. I now need to do that. And I need to take account of anomalous dimensions. So when I rescale my field, I need to take account of the canonical dimension here, and also the field strength renormalization here, which has the anomalous dimension in it. And I rescale my momenta as well, no anomalous dimension here. And I've already mentioned the energy time. The problem with this is that this rescaling produces an annoying change to the Polchinski equation. Now, this lambda here was a constant phi, and I've rescaled the field so I get a correction on the right-hand side. That one isn't annoying to me, that one's perfectly fine. The problem is that the rescaling, because I've got these derivatives here, it causes this 1 over z to appear on the right-hand side. There's nothing wrong with this. It would just make what I'm going to try and do a little bit more awkward. And so I want to get rid of it. Also, particularly because it appears in my definition of the dual action, and I just don't want it there. So I introduced these, when I introduced the Polchinski equation, I motivated it by coming from these very general flow equations. And part of the reason I went through that route was because I actually want to now use this generality to take an equation which is very slightly different from the Polchinski equation. And what I want to do is I want to exploit this freedom such that after I've done this rescaling, the z has disappeared from the right-hand side. So you can imagine before I did the rescaling, I had an extra z sitting here. And this is perfectly legitimate to do from my previous discussion. It corresponds to a nicely well-defined flow equation. And this was first introduced by Ball and et al. Around about 1993, I think. And this is nothing new. And as usual, I'm just defining the anomalous dimension as follows. My dual action is defined the same as before, but its flow is going to be different. This is just from the rescaling, but I now do get something on the right-hand side of the equation. This is because I've changed my flow equation. So it's not just a matter of doing a rescaling, which would introduce this change. I've made a change to the flow equation, and so you can go through and check and get an extra correction on the right-hand side. So that's the price I've had to pay for using a different flow equation, if you like. So my flow equation for the dual action becomes slightly more complicated. And the final things I want to do is, that was the hard part, scaling out z, the anomalous part. Now what I want to do is scale out the canonical dimensions. So that's what I'm doing here. And this is what my flow equation for the dual action becomes. So the term on the right-hand side will stay the same. I've still got my dt. This term here was from my anomalous rescaling, and I'll say where these guys are from in a moment. So this guy is from the canonical dimension, and what this is, this delta partial, it's a derivative counting operator, and it just simply arises because I've done this rescaling of the momentum here. So because I've got a lambda here, I've changed my powers of lambda by rescaling the momentum, I need to compensate for that. And the final thing to note is the rescale propagator is independent of t. There was an over lambda squared here. This rescaling has got rid of it. And so at a fixed point, I have this. And let me just justify that.
I should have cleaned this board before. What I've got is I've got that d is equal to the logarithm of this guy. I said, because of my rescalings, this is independent of lambda.
a fixed point by definition. This is independent of lambda, there's a star on it, which means that at a fixed point, this one is also independent of lambda. So rather than using S to analyze fixed points, rather than using this equation to analyze fixed points, I'm going to use this linear equation to analyze fixed points instead. So the summary so far. So this is the definition of my dual action. Physically what it's doing is it's collecting together the correlation functions, and it satisfies a simple linear equation, unlike the exact normalization group equation, which is non-linear. This one is much simpler. And up until this point, and indeed from next transparency, so far all I've done with diagrammatics is using to help interpretation. And that will be continued onto this transparency, but not beyond that. So let me actually look at the two-point vertex. I'm at a fixed point, so I want to set the derivative of the dual action to zero. And this is the flow equation that I get. Now let me analyze this for small p. Well, for small p, this term and this term are of the same order, but this guy here is subleading. So if I just solve the left-hand side, I see that this must be p, basically, to this power here. So this is my solution. I've also put in some of the subleading terms here. This is for e to star not equal to zero. For e to star equal to zero, the right-hand side vanishes, and this is, in fact, the exact solution. And now I can do a sanity check, so hopefully this will convince you that what I'm doing is actually making some type of sense. So recall that the two-point correlation function, I could write it in terms of this E2 and this bare vector propagator. Let me now substitute in using my solution here, and I might fix the floor.
There's an eraser.
Keep going. So what I've got is I've got my Z propagation, which is 1 over p squared. I've got 1 minus, I'll put in my Z propagator first, I've got 1 over p squared, and then I've got b, p squared, 1 plus e to star over 2, plus p squared, plus other stuff. So you can see that this p squared and that p squared cancel, with a minus 1, which cancels against that, and then what I've got is I've got this power of p squared here, and I've got two inverse powers of p squared there. So this stays positive, the sign of that has changed. And so what I end up with is this expression here. Now hopefully one or two of you might recognize this as the generic form that is expected for critical fixed point behavior. And I don't actually know of any derivation in complete generality as quick as this from a sort of from a rigorous starting point, if you like. So there are certainly heuristic arguments for doing this, but in terms of an argument directly from the exact normalization group, there are some quite long-winded things. I haven't seen anything as a set of directives, where I just define my dual action, solve it as a fixed point, and I automatically get this complete generality in any number of dimensions. So this in itself is quite an interesting result and hints that this is going along the right path. And just also mention, well, I said that this guy had an interpretation, the ultraviolet regularized version of this, so a small momentum just has the same behavior. And just as usual, one finds that the one PI vertex and the two-point correlation function are inverse to each other. So this is the first part, and now I need to use my diagrammatics, and this is where my demonstration of triviality comes in. So what I want to do is I want to re-sum diagrams as follows. So this is the diagrammatic expansion I wrote down before. Oh, actually, sorry, not quite. I'm considering D bar here. This is just one PI diagrams. But I want to replace my black lines by red lines. I'll just resum classes of diagrams into the propagators. And I'm now going to analyze these diagrams as small p. So p is the momentum flowing into the vertex. So my first assumption is that S has a derivative expansion. So in other words, I can expand it an infinite number of derivatives, or I can Taylor expand it in momentum. And that's sometimes called quasi-locality. Now, I've just shown that this has non-analytic behavior, and the only place this can come from is from divergences in loop integrals. So let's have a look at what I've got. Well, this is my first diagram. I said that this has a Taylor expansion, so I can just expand this as follows. This is my next diagram. Now you can see the momentum is just flowing in this leg and out of this leg. It never goes around the loop here. So again, there's no non-analyticity that can be introduced, and this just has some other coefficients the same form. So finally, let's look at this diagram here. This one's the interesting one, because it's transparency to itself. So what I'm doing is I'm just looking at small momentum here. I'm looking at small loop momentum because I'm saying that any non-analytic behavior in P has to come from small momentum. So let me just throw away the ultraviolet stuff. And because these address detector propagators, well, I know how they scale. I know that they've got the normal momentum dimension of a propagator multiplied by this factor here. So let me look at this in the infrared. I'm going to check the infrared divergences. So my net power of momenta, I've got 2 powers of d coming from here. And then what I've got is I've got 2, 4, 6 times this factor here. Right. I now want to focus on d equals 4 plus epsilon. And for this part of the talk, I'm just going to consider non-negative anomalous dimensions. So I can write this as follows. And you can see there's never any danger of getting incorrect divergences here. This has a positive power. Fine. But now let me consider this guy instead, where I take a second derivative. And now my net power of momentum has changed. It's the same as before, but I've got this extra minus 2 because I'm changing, I've got this extra derivative here. I've got 2 more inverse powers of momentum. Again, let me take this here. So I now get this right-hand side. You can see that this is going to be positive in the following situations. If epsilon is 0, then I need e to star greater than 0. If epsilon is greater than 0, well, then this can be 0 or more. So for this, for these two combinations, then again, up to order p squared in rate, this guy has a Taylor expansion. Beyond here, I don't mind. I don't mind if it's non-analytic beyond here. This doesn't concern me. The power counting I've done for this diagram, you can very straightforwardly generalize it to all diagrams, and you find the following result. That for the same restrictions that I just mentioned, you find that the full one particle irreducible two-point guy goes as C plus dP squared. But from the solution to my equation, I know that it must take this form. So by comparison, well, I can immediately see that C equals 0. This is nothing surprising. This is just telling me if I want to be at a critical fixed point, it better be massless. But you can see that by comparing this, the only way to reconcile these two expressions is if the anomalous dimension is 0. So now I'm in a position to state my case of triviality. So the summary is, consider this case here, so 4 plus epsilon dimensions with a non-negative anomalous dimension. If I work in 4 dimensions, and the anomalous dimension is bigger than 0, I don't have any solutions. If I take epsilon greater than 0 and just relax this, this can become an equality, and force to take e to equal 0. So I can combine these results and say that as long as e is non-negative and d is greater than or equal to 4, I must take vanishing anomalous dimension. So, to complete the argument, well, the first thing to notice is there's a theorem due to Polnaea which implies the following. It's an integer number of dimensions. If at a fixed point the anomalous dimension vanishes, then the theorem tells you that the fixed point must be the Gaussian one. Now, unfortunately, I don't have time to do it, but I can actually show that this follows... So, by showing that e to star equals 0, triviality follows in d equals 4 as a consequence of this theorem. Unfortunately, I don't have time in this talk to do it, but I can show this directly, generalizing the previous arguments, or adding to the previous arguments, both in d equals 4 and also d greater than 4. So just to conclude, this is essentially my last transparency, everything I've done so far has been for positive anomalous dimension. What about negative anomalous dimension? Well, these certainly exist, and they were found by Fechner back in the 70s. And what he found is there's a family of fixed points of this following form. So if you notice, e to star starts at minus 2, which means that this kinetic term here starts at p to the 4. So these correspond to higher derivative theories. And the bond continuations in the Minkowski space, I'm not going to be interested in these. And as an aside, well, I won't go into any more, but they're actually not important in this matter either. If I'm interested, they can ask me why when I've finished. Now, what about non-trivial fixed points about the negative anomalous dimension? Well, I can't show that they don't exist, but what I can show is that if they do exist, just like Wegener's ones, they correspond to non-unitary theories. So unfortunately, I don't have time to give the proof now. That's the claim. So the conclusion then, so the scalar field theory in four or more dimensions, is that there are no non-trivial fixed points which exist with a quasi-local action to this was this requirement that there had to exist a derivative expansion that had non-negative anomalous dimension. Any fixed point with the anomalous dimension less than zero are non-unitary. So my claim is that the only physically acceptable non-perturbatively renormalizable field theories, which I'm claiming will follow from fixed points, are true field. Just to quickly conclude, one can also apply this to pure abelian gauge theory in a non-compact formulation in any number of dimensions. And the same conclusions apply to the scalar chiral sink field. I think the very last comment I'd like to make is, because I think it's quite illuminating, as to why I put Wessonino model in brackets, because this is, if you like, the philosophy behind my whole approach. So what I'm saying is, I'm not interested in considering a particular model, like the Wessonino model or lambda 5 to 4 model. I say consider all possible scalar field theories, or if you like, all possible supersymmetric theories, whatever. Consider all the ones you can. And now I'm using the exact renormalization group to tell you which the renormalizable theories are. So the recipe for that is you look for fixed points, and then you additionally look for renormalized trajectories that come out. I think that sort of change of emphasis, if you like, is key to the whole approach that I've taken. So that concludes the talk, so thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.
Time for comments or questions?
Just a question on your very last remark about gauge theories. A lot of your argument starts getting made kind of legally and different if you can choose different gauges.
One of the remarkable things in NACLG is, as I emphasized throughout the talk, you have this freedom to block as you choose, and you can actually formulate gauge theory in a manifestly gauge invariant way with no gauge fixing at all. So that problem is removed. The reason I can only do this in pure gauge theory, there is related to gauge invariant, this is actually a really interesting question, I think. Might indicate the way here is, because obviously you'd like to do something, for example, like QED rather than pure abelian gauge theory. Well, the natural way to do this in this formalism seems to be to use a manifest gauge invariant approach. Okay, that you can certainly set that up, and that seems to be the way to do it. Now, the point is that the key element to my arguments was the correlation functions. Now, I use the correlation functions, or the dual action to take the correlation functions to do this argument, this argument of triviality. But if I don't fix the gauge, then the normal correlation functions that I write down just vanish because they're not manifestly gauge invariant. So this suggests that if I want to try and use this formalism in QE, I have to actually almost go back right to the beginning and reconsider what I even mean, for example, by scattering. And I really need to be scattering, for example, gauge invariant objects together. And this is something I very much like to investigate, because it sort of suggests that if this approach is right, to do this without gauge fixing is kind of giving you a direction that's to go. So that's something I'd like to test.
To understand the result, a priori, when you started investigating this, you could have maybe you were looking for non-trivial fixed points like in 3D, like the Wilson-Fisher, and the result is that actually such a thing does not exist.
In 4D.
You were looking if in 4D
existed
a non-trivial fixed point.
As soon as you go below 4D, then you start getting for divergences, which you introduce as non-analytic. Whether I can use this to find non-trivial fixed points rather than show that they don't exist. So.
No, my question was, were you hoping to find non-trivial fixed points?
No, well, I didn't. I had no idea. It really came out of just trying to understand some diagrammatic spectrum. I wrote this stuff down. Basically, I found that this behavior is 1 over e squared to 1 minus e squared to 2, and for about a month I thought, this must be complete garbage I'm getting on that behavior. If I looked at it long enough, I realized it was actually giving me the universal behavior I'd fixed, and I realized, actually maybe there's something useful that this is doing.
What do you mean by, first of all, pure abelian gauge? Isn't that a free theory?
Oh, well, so again, it's the question is, you need to demonstrate that it's a free theory.
Sure means no other field.
Right. But you could have an arbitrarily complicated action. It could, in principle, be a fixed point action or a trajectory coming out of a fixed point action. So sure, if you just write down f nu nu squared for a pure theory, it's free. You could imagine putting any
number. You could imagine some other action.
So it's like the sort of point I was making with this, just because it's all possible theories you can write down. And then the exact RG tell you which ones are renormalized and which ones aren't.
So the statement is you always just get a free theory. If there's any fixed point at all, it has to be
the trigger one. So none of the results here, they're not surprising. none of these are unexpected.
But what do you mean in the case of the Villegas theory? Because in the case of the scalar theory, I would imagine just random potentials, 4 or 5.
Right.
Whereas for the Villegas theory, I'm engaging violence.
Right, any potential was gained. So you can have arbitrary powers of f nu nu squared, for example.
No, because you could have,
this will be higher derivative.
Right. No, just say consider anything you want. The only
but there's some locality.
Well, the only constraint I'm putting regarding locality is I'm saying my action must have a Taylor expansion. I'm not even saying that it has to have anything. That's the only restriction that I'm putting on. So I'm considering all actions as long as they have a Taylor expansion or derivative expansion.
So if you take the usual action squared, that would also be okay for you.
So an f nu squared plus f nu to 4.
No, integral of f nu nu squared.
Okay, so what that would correspond to is this, that would correspond to one of these ones with negative anomalous dimension. Now, they fixed points like that, certainly, well, Gaussian style ones do exist. Let me just go back. That's very nice. So I think you're talking about the analog of this, right? So these ones certainly exist and they're certainly fixed points, but they have negative anomalous dimension. And they're higher derivative theories, and so upon continuation, they're non unitary.
What do you mean by non unitary? I mean, are you talking perturbative development? Yeah, I'm confused about what you mean by. I know what unitary means.
Right.
What do you mean by non-unitary here?
How do I show it for these?
How do you show it, for example?
Actually, that's a good question. And there's a point in which I don't fully understand about this, to be completely frank. So the only derivation that I know of, and this might just be my ignorance, is for example one using the Callan-Lehmann spectrum representation. Now, as far as I understand it, that requires some mass gap for that to work. So I may be misunderstanding that. In which case, you'd have to imagine this is a limiting procedure as you go to the fixed point, that the mass goes to zero. So you can show from the Callan-Lehmann spectral representation, I think you have a mass gap, I'm not sure about that, but if you've got a propagator which falls off faster than 1 over p squared, the theory is non-unitary, you get negative probabilities. Now, there is a mass in that demonstration. You can certainly take it arbitrarily small. I don't actually know of a direct derivation. So that's something I'm
not sure. I don't either, so that's fine.
If anybody else does, I'd be delighted to hear about it.
Also, what did you mean by the non-compact formulas? I mean, it's not U1, but it's
Right.
The group is R rather than
Right, yes. Yeah. Because the compact one that admits monopoles in the masses formulation.
And therefore, this doesn't apply.
Yes. Well, I haven't. I just haven't even looked at that case.
That's the physically most relevant case.
Right. So that's the one that Polyakov showed has got non-trivial.
Oh, we know it does have.
Right. And I simply haven't looked at it.
So one last one, or at least for me, last one. What? What relation does this have to? I mean, there are other proofs in the literature that have I'm not sure I really understand those proofs, but they don't appear to make any assumptions about fixed points. Fixed points existing.
Right, so this comes back to the very last point I made about the Coulomb Wessolino model. So the philosophy that these other proofs make, which are certainly, I would say, more rigorous than this, they'll take, for example, a lambda 5-4 model on a lattice,
right.
A strictly lambda 5-4 model. And I'll say, does it make sense if I send the lattice size to zero? And they will say, no, it doesn't. So I want to take the opinion, well, so an obvious objection to that is not an objection to the proof itself, but well, why not add a small 5-6 or 5-8? So I said, I want to change the focus and say, if I just want to consider completely general theories, with no restriction on which particular model I'm choosing, and see which fixed points exist.
Oh, you mean so those proofs leave open that
yeah.
at low energies it could look like lambda 5-4.
Right.
But at high energies it could look different than it could have.
Right, they don't, as I understand.
For example, a nice fixed point.
Right, right.
Which only your proof would
roll. Yes, yeah, so I looked explicitly for the fixed points rather than seeing if a particular flows into something.
So those proofs are, in some sense, not conclusive.
Right, yeah. Because you know that the effectivist theory is to an excellent approximation lambda phi for a single Gaussian fixed point. But there's still an infinite number in principle of very small irrelevant terms. Now, sure, they're irrelevant for Gaussian fixed point, but there's no reason that they should be irrelevant in the ultraviolet. Because the classification of relevance and irrelevance depends on which fixed point you're in the vicinity of.
Is there any other comments? If not, let's stand.